Okay, folks, welcome again to From the Horse's Mouth with your founder of Equitopia, Caroline Hegarty. So we're here again with Shauna Kerrish. Hopefully you've listened to our prior podcast on some of the words of wisdom she had to say. We're going to delve a little bit deeper into the role of behaviour and how we can equip some of the owners and riders with more information on how to manage the relationship with their horse as it relates to behaviour. So one of the questions in terms of having a two-way communication with horses is how do riders perhaps go about determining like the responses from a horse and figuring out does the horse understand what I'm doing? Is there a pain issue? Are they saying I really don't want to do this? Or how do we figure out when a horse has a behavior that we are not looking for? How do we determine what they're trying to say to us, and how do we distinguish how to move forward from that in terms of tools in our tool belt to figure out what might be going on?
Okay. Well, first of all, it's lovely to see you again. Yes, I think what's really the bottom line is they're finding it undesirable. They do not want to do this for whatever reason it is. So whether it's pain, whether it's confusion, whether it's I don't like not knowing the answer, or fear, or there's a horse next door that's, you know, whatever it might be, the bottom line is they're not wanting to do it. They're not finding it reinforcing to do this behavior. So sometimes I can tell what it is, and I'll be clear that this is, I can tell this is confusion. I can tell this is discomfort. I can tell this is worry about something. But there's sometimes I can't tell. So I think one of the things to first distinguish, watch all those little things. And when you're in the saddle, boy, do you feel that. That moment that they soften, you can feel that softening. And I reinforce that quite a bit. But there is a little bit of an ethical question, because horses can do more than they're comfortable doing. So there's certain, especially they can do it with traditional training. They can certainly do it with positive reinforcement. So really trying to find those little tiny nuances. You know, is a horse's head just a little bit higher than normal? Is he being a little bit bulky and I don't know why, or just a little stiffer or a little bit? So I then try to question all of those pieces there. I think if we can get good people around us, we can then make the determination. My biggest fear is I always want to go physical first. If there's a behavior change in any capacity, I first want to look at some physical causes. Because if it is a new saddle and the saddle's not fitting, or maybe they pulled their back when they were in the turnout and playing and now they're having pain or whatever it is, I want to rule out that there's not physical discomfort there. So number one, I get to a vet, or, you know, the body workers are finding a good body worker is worth their weight in gold, because they can say, yeah, they're a little stiff in the pole, or there's big stiffness in the shoulder, or there's pain in there. So I would go back to some finding, get my good resources and trying to rule out the pain. So first things first, I want to rule out pain. So now let's say we found pain and we've dealt with it, and they may now have the memory of the pain. Or we've dealt with the pain and now they're like, I'm good. You know, I'm not holding on to that. I'm good to go. Now I need to rebuild the association. So I start little, you know, and I don't care. The horse that's in front of me today is the horse that's in front of me today. And I don't care what we did yesterday. And yesterday we jumped, whatever, you know, big things we did. If today the horse is having trouble with something, I don't mind going back to baby steps and saying, you know what? I have building blocks that we learn this behavior. So if I've trained it through positive reinforcement, I may be getting off and doing what I call the reverse round pen, or different tools that can create and make sure he's moving as well, and break it down to the little steps that I use to build the behavior in the first place. So I'd never mind doing that. And usually what happens is they will go quickly through it, you know, but I can go back, because one of the things I find, clarity brings relaxation. So if they're unclear or apprehensive, then I can, and I push through it, I can create more tension. And then more tension is going to create more knottedness, you know, and more all of that. So I go back and say, let's get back to a good place mentally and physically where we can do this behavior and we're back to working together. If I feel like a horse isn't working with me, I'm not going to make them do it. There's always tomorrow. I'll just say, okay, that's fine. You're having a bad day. I'm just going to put you home and we'll try again tomorrow. And typically it's an isolated case. You know, you get back on and then they're like, okay, for whatever reason, I was in a weird place. But the trick is, I think when we use positive reinforcement, putting the horse away is not necessarily something they really want to do. So if I feel like, you know, I'm trying And I want the relationship to feel 50-50. I think boundaries are really important. So if I feel like I'm trying, I'm doing everything I could, I took steps back, you're still kind of feeling like you're not going there, I make sure it's not personal. I never take it personally. I just say, okay, that's all right. You don't have to do this today. You don't have to work today. I'll go ahead and put you back and we'll try again tomorrow. And
so that leads actually to my very next question, because, you know, we have the horse on one side and then we have the rider. So we look at all the motivations of the horses and we can address those with behavior. Do you find sometimes that the rider sometimes can be a little more impatient because they want to get to riding? And if in that case, is there some motivation or something that will help them understand the benefits of the long-term benefits of being patient when it comes to, you know, wanting to get to the riding but have it be the best possible?
Yes, and I think that's a really good question, because I think culturally and historically, horse people have been, you know, get on, get do it, make them do it. He's, you know, and it's been this culture of, you know, getting on with our agenda and don't let them get away with that. You know, but if we've really done our training right, they should be enjoying this training. They should find it relaxing, energetically relaxing, but they should find it relaxing and they look forward to it and they want to work with us and they want to cooperate. If I don't have that relationship on a day-to-day basis, then I haven't done my job right. You know what I mean? I should get on and feel like my horse is here and we are together and he is listening the whole way and we're figuring it out and I'm listening to him just as much. So I think it really is tricky to get the person to slow down and really look to the horse. But there's something I say all the time. I say, slow down, you'll go faster. And it relates to this exactly, because it's saying, no big deal, I'll put you away and we'll try again tomorrow. Now, if it kept going where tomorrow was worse and it kept going, then I have to come up with a new plan. I'm going to go back to the drawing board. But mostly it's a one-off, you know, they didn't sleep well. Do they have a headache? I mean, I don't know if horses have headaches, but, you know, whatever. I have my bad days.
Some body works have come and say headaches if you've got problems in the TMJ. And
yes.
If they've had a, you know, pull back on a halter or something that they've wrenched their pole. Yeah.
They could have, you know, a bad day for whatever reason. So I put them away. But I really do feel like if we slow down and we get them emotionally, mentally right and clarity and getting it and getting the relaxation, they get right back on track. So sometimes if we've gone off track, I just say, slow down, take your time and get through it. Build that foundation correctly. And in the long term, the training speeds up faster and faster and faster than traditional training when you're using positive reinforcement, because now there's something in it for the horse. I mean, think about it. What's in it for your horse to do a canter depart? Not much. But as soon as you put something in it for them, they become interested in the training. They come, actually, there's something in it for them, so they become invested in the training. And now they're looking for the answer as much as you are. So if I feel like if I have a bad day or that relationship isn't that solid, I say, go back and build it. Let it go. It's not forcing through it isn't going to get a better emotional horse. Get back and just go, okay, for whatever reason, there is some hole somewhere that we need to work through and get it back on track. And then I promise you, things, when your horse is just going, I'm listening, what could you possibly want? And they look to it without fear. You know, the first time I remember asking Minty for a collection, you just go, little this, little that. And I was warned that I can get worried. And he didn't get worried. He just thought, I know this, I know that. There's an answer here somewhere. And he worked with me. And in the long run, I remember people commenting saying, he's like a, you know, at five, you know, they're like, he's like a 10 or 11 year old horse. So, but that was the slowdown. You go faster. Now I have a horse who's more sensible and listening. So I think going back and building that foundation, however long it takes, is going to, in the long run, really serve you way better, both of you better. And I think
Absolutely.
That's important.
Yeah, I find that there's a lot of myths out there that people assign these, attribute these things to horses, where they go back and plot that they're going to do this today to avoid riding, or they're pretending to be lame so they don't have to go to work, or that when you don't get to the end and make them do something, then you've taught them that they can, that they're going to come out tomorrow with the same, oh, this happened yesterday, so therefore if I do this, I'm going to avoid that. So the cognitive abilities of horses, I think, is very misunderstood. So do you find that when you go out, and do you have any what do you say, or how do you overcome, or how do you explain to people that horses don't have that
yes.
ability to plot and plan?
And it is something that people think, well, if I put him home, he's getting away with it. And you're like, okay, wait a second. And I try to remind people, again, I go to science quite often, but I try to remind something, if they're doing something, it's only because it's worked for them. You know, they've learned through operant conditioning that if I do this, I get this. It's not a malicious plan. They're not out to spite you or get you. But what I look at it is then go, well, then if you want to avoid that more than you want to do it, this is up to me. You didn't ask to be here. I chose this for you. So it's up to me as the human thinking, cognitive, extra-cognitive person that I can, I need to figure out how to get it where you find it more reinforcing to do the thing than you do to avoid the thing. So I think that is a really basic premise. If we can just look at it that way and go, this is on me now. So now what can I do to change his emotions and his feelings and his desire to want to do this? And I talk a lot about emotions because I really, you know, they are sentient beings. We're finding out more and more how animals really do have so much more emotions going on with things. So I think to understand that from a compassionate sense is really important. But they're not malicious. You know, they aren't born going, I'm going to be a maniacal horse my entire life. They've just learned these things. So it's up to us to create. And there's something called the differential reinforcement of an incompatible behavior. I know that sounds like a mouthful. It's right out of textbooks. But basically, it's saying I've got this behavior, which I don't want. So I want to replace it with this behavior. What do I need to do? I need to rebalance the reinforcement history. You know, so they're choosing the one that has served them the best. I want to make this other new behavior serve them best. You know, so changing that differential, the reinforcement history behind it is what I really look at. So if a horse really is going, I don't like left lead canter, period. And I've sorted out, made sure we've gone to everybody I can to be sure that, you know, the body worker, the vet, the chiropractor, whatever I can to get to be sure that's not a physical cause, then I think, well, then I need to help create probably better balance and more, you know, muscle development on that side. But how can I do that? How can I create it where he wants to do this and chooses to do this, but it's his choice? So as I start at liberty, I start everything I can at liberty. And then that tells me when they're doing it, they're choosing to do it, they're doing it consistently, they're doing it well, that's their choice. Now they're finding that behavior reinforcing because they will go do it quite readily. And I think that if I get on and do it and make it, I don't know how much is really their choice. Would they walk away? Would they run to the other end of the arena? Or would they stick with me and choose to do it? So at liberty, it tells me that they're there and they've got it. And it's a great way to help build up that behavior, that reinforcement history, and then go back and, I even have steps for introducing the rider, but not all the way yet, you know. So there's steps you can take, but it is taking it down to little itty bitty tiny pieces so that these little tiny building blocks can build the behavior. So I think really.
So maybe we could take a look at a quick example, because I know behavior is complicated. So, you'll see frequently people say with their horse and the cross ties and the horse is pawing and they just immediately instinctively want to go over and smack the horse for pawing. So that would fall into the negative punishment, is it?
Yes.
Punishment?
Yes.
Positive
punishment.
Positive punishment. Yeah, sorry. See, complicated.
It is.
And so would there be something that you could say, could you maybe break that down a little bit as a specific behavior and say someone is, their horse is pawing and instead of going over to smack the horse, is there something that you would say that, what would you do? What
yes.
would you suggest to that person?
And first of all, I try to think about, you know, I try to look, is there something physically going on? You know, is there, it could be a communication that my stomach's upset or, you know, whatever. So I try to rule that out as best I can. But if it's something that goes on chronically, then it probably is something that was learned as a young horse. But one of the biggest things people do, one of the best things for positive reinforcement anyway, is I try to ignore unwanted behavior. Now, safety is always a factor. So if a horse is truly trying to bite me to hurt me, I mean, like maliciously going to take a chunk out, I'm going to stop that and get out of there any way that I can and then regroup and think, oh, golly, what can I do? So you always think safety first and foremost. But if a horse is just kind of nipping at me, I'm going to just kind of teach him to keep his head away and teach something else to replace that behavior. Because oftentimes, and pawing is like this, nipping is like this, it can just be that they want attention. And the best thing you can do is to ignore that behavior and say, well, that's just not going to get, there's no response is going to come from me. So if you're not going to get any response, what's the point? And now it starts to die off. But it is very true. People come up and go, stop it. You know, now all of a sudden the horse gets attention. Or they start the young colt that they've now isolated because he's going to be a stallion. He's like, I just want to have social interactions and I'm young and I have a strong play drive. And then they see the human, then they start like nipping at him. Then the human starts swinging and they're like, perfect, we're sparring because this is what I want to do. And then people are like, I don't know why he bites. And you're like, well, you know, but so there's a lot of things we, I think us humans do unintentionally that end up reinforcing that behavior. And we, I think this is really important. We don't decide what is good or bad. The behavior, does it increase in frequency or decrease in frequency? So if we start swinging at a horse or going over and fussing at the horse who's pawing in the cross ties and pawing is either remaining the same or increasing, something's reinforcing it. So just break that down for a minute and go, and it's hard because you start to go, dang it, I just, it's annoying. Walk away, just walk away. And that, I think that's the best thing. But something to be aware of, we also have something called extinction burst. So a behavior that has been reinforced, they've gotten what they want because of it. So this is something that has served them. They've gotten so much attention for pawing in the cross ties. And now we decide, nope, I'm going to ignore it. And so now this is trained. And consistency is key. So don't do one and then the other, because now you're going to make the behavior more resilient. So what I do is I just say, it will increase in frequency because they're going to think this has worked. This has worked. This has worked. Dang it. This has worked. Why isn't it working? So the behavior will actually, they'll try harder with that behavior before they finally start to go, oh, it's not working. So keeping in mind, if it kind of starts to increase a little bit at first for something that has gone on, don't just get discouraged. Keep it up and stick with it. But know that if you're ignoring it, you're not adding to the problem. So I think it's really important to consider that ignoring the unwanted behavior, as long as it's relatively safe, you know, that
is an option. Yes. Rather than going over and smacking the horse.
Yes, it's a much better option. Awesome. And then I look at it and I think, or is it tension? So if it's tension, then I look at the components that could be part of it. I still will ignore I won't draw attention to the pawing. So I will ignore that still, but I may think, are you worried about the saddle coming on? Or are you worried about the riding? So if I have issues that come down the line from that, I would then think maybe this is a precursor. They're trying to say, I know what comes next and I'm showing tension. So one of the things I try to work for is relaxation in everything that they do. And I mean, energetic relaxation, because I want energy. I like focused, relaxed energy. So I kind of keep that in the back of my mind. Is there some other component that feels where I feel like they're ill at ease? And I will address that separately. But there's some horses that it simply is, I just want attention. Somebody come back here and play with me.
So the role of environment in horse behavior, is there science behind that, or how important is the environment in which they're kept and how they're kept in their daily routine and stuff like that? And how does a rider or a trainer evaluate that, and how does that impact how you come to a client first and try to figure out what their problem is in relation to the bigger picture of the horse?
Yeah, and I think it is hugely important, because if we have, you know, and some people can't do ideally what we would do, you know, there's circumstances, they live in Los Angeles, you know, and if they want to have a horse that's going to be in a stable and they can't just say, you're going to be on a track paddock with five other or whatever it is. So sometimes we have our limitations, but there's things we can do to really maximize everything that we're doing with horses. So, I think it's also important to keep in mind, horses are individuals. Not everybody likes or dislikes the same thing. I had my horse Minty, and I had him, he was a horse who had part of his day was always in a stall, not all day, you know, part of it. And then I had him living outside, and I took him to a clinic, and I put him in, it was a big mare stall for the clinic. And I was like, uh-oh, you love a stall. And I wasn't giving him a stall at that time. You know, there's something about him, I think he's an exception to the rule, but you could see he was at peace and calm and relaxed. So you're really trying to keep a big picture of the whole thing. But I think it's balance that is so important. So if we have a horse that's standing for 23 hours or 22 hours in their stall, that's really hard and really challenging. So ideally, if we can get them out, get them socialized, so letting them have time with other horses. And I know that's show horses, people are like, no, he might get a nick or he might get hurt. Well, I kind of think they can also kill themselves in their stall. So I think I would just as soon have them out and having that social interaction and engagement. That a lot of times will take away a lot of tension or a lot of unhappiness. So if we can do that, I really try to encourage people to think about ways they can at least get socialization. Maybe their horse can live outside or be outside through the day and then come in at night. Or, you know, there's other options. So I think the physical environment is really, really important. The way we're keeping them is something we can change a lot. And if we do have a horse who's in a lot, do as much as you can for environmental enrichment. You know, get them, you know, balls. There's big balls you can put hay in and some random cookies. You know, we take ropes and put carrots and apples through it, you know, so you just untwist it and put it in. And then they kind of have to figure out, how do I get it out? Then we have zippers that go up and down so they can figure that out. So we have things that keep their mind involved. I heard a study, or I heard a statistic not that long ago, about humans, but that 80% of our energy goes to cognitive thinking and problem solving. So when we are doing that, we're not doing it all day long. Sometimes we're watching TV or something, but it is actually very tiring, you know? So if we can kind of engage their head, we're giving them some place to put their energy. So I think that if you have a horse that you can't do the ideal situation, do what you can to create stimulation and interaction, positive reinforcement training, teaching, bring them out to teach, to recognize and pick different colors, to do a bow, do silly stuff. This is also very engaging and enriching for them and something they look forward to. So it really, a lot has to do with how we keep them. Do they have hay all the time? That's really an important factor. Can we, and then it comes down to even just training sessions. I always think, how can I set them up for succeed, to succeed? And mostly I think about that as their environment. If I'm trying to work on a horse kind of with a relaxed trot, I'm not going to take him to the arena he hates or where, whatever area he hates. I'm going to take him where I think, where are you most likely to be able to focus and do this and build this? You know, so I think there's a lot of things we can do in their environment that also helps to create them to choose the right thing. It gives us something to reinforce.
That sounds great. And that gives me an idea of maybe perhaps at some point, Shauna and I will sit down and look at doing something about enrichment ideas for horses that are more specific, so we can guide you on the journey to doing that. So you can feel free to send us an email or comment on Facebook if you would like more information on how to really design an enrichment program for your horses. It also leads to another question. And I know a lot of people are limited by how they keep their horses, and people are a little bit worried about introducing horses to each other. So is there any tips you can give for, you know, again, not all horses, of course, are going to get along. So is there any tips for, you know, someone says, gosh, I would like to try and socialize my horse more, and I would like to try maybe putting them out with another horse or whatever. Is there any tips towards making them feel more confident about that being less likely to end up in, you know, yeah, my horse gets kicked or something like that?
And I do think that. And the horses are different. You know, some horses are better if they're just blumped in there, and some are, you know, so because they're individuals. But really, I'll try to start them with either the herd or an individual over a fence. So if they can have a touching fence where they can see each other, they can smell each other, they can get that out a little bit. But sometimes the fence creates this false bravado. You know what I mean? So once the fence is gone, then they're like, oh, never mind. You know, so, but it's a way that at least they can know each other a little bit. And if I'm introducing, because we have a track paddock, and so I introduce, you know, horses that have been show horses and not really socialized very much into the track paddock with five other horses that are already out there. And so what I'll do is I'll a lot of times put the first one out with the mildest one. So the new horse goes with the mildest one, and they can go explore and get some energy out. And always think about, how can we get the energy out first a lot of times? Because if there's too much pent-up energy when we put the horses all together, sometimes that just turns to butts flying versus, you know, if they're a little more relaxed, then you're more apt to get more relaxed kind of. I'm too tired for that. Yeah, exactly. And I always give them, make sure there's lots of food and in different places. So if you don't have grass, which in California and New Mexico can be more of a rarity, but you will, I make sure there's different piles of hay all around, or even maybe hay nets and things that they can pull from and engage in that. But I make sure there's lots of food around, because a lot of times that is a great equalizer. You know, there's like, I'm just eating. So we'll kind of say hi, and then I'm going to go eat. But I'm taking the extra energy off if I can. So if I know one is kind of an antagonist, I will take and make sure that one, we've gone and done something that maybe has settled you down a little bit, you know, that you have had this other fun thing you've done, and now you come in here a little quieter. But I tend to put them in with the quieter one first, and then start introducing them one by one into them, so they can get associated with in a safer feeling, so they don't go in feeling quite so defensive, but they can get, but sometimes you have somebody who's a big it is an antagonizer himself. So you put him in, you're like, oh, poor other mild guy is now being chased up and down. But then I start introducing him a little more quickly. It's always a risk, and there's no guarantee that, you know, we're not going to come out in places. But I, you know, this is a thing that John Madden did. He really, he pulled shoes and turned horses out, you know, and you're talking $1 million horse, you know, or something that he, you know, he didn't mind letting them be horses, and knowing that they needed to be horses was really important. And I think that that, and that was 25 years ago, you know, and that is something that's only become more aware as we go. But horses are horses. We need to let them naturally be a horse as best we can. And even if it's for parts of the day, Minty now, because I know he does like his stall, he goes out all day on a track paddock with five other horses. And then in the nighttime, he can come back in and have a stall and get his rest. And then the morning, he goes back out. So it's kind of, I found a way to find a nice balance for him where he goes, okay, good. I can let it all down and relax now. So I think, yeah, just it is a cautionary tale, but as much as you can interact, get them to interact.
Well, there's caution with everything. As you say, they can hurt themselves in their stalls. We've had all kinds of various creative ways where horses can injure themselves, whether they're in, out, or
yes,
or just standing still. So I'd like to thank you again, Sean. I think this has been really enlightening. That's a lot of information, and I hope it will give people pause to really just understand that, you know, horses have 24 hours a day outside of, you know, the hour that they might spend with you. They still have a life, and we need to consider that, and the relationship between the competition and their performance. All these things matter, so we do need to keep in mind that the whole picture is important to your riding, and it's not isolated where we're just talking about things that don't relate to your wanting to ride or to be in competition or to go trail riding or whatever you want to do. All this stuff is part of a training program that will allow you to be successful for you and your horse. So stay tuned for further podcasts and for further information, and hopefully we'll get to doing an enrichment program course that will allow you to get better resources for your horses, and we shall talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.